A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
12 humans have ever stood on another world. That's fewer than the number of people in this recording studio right now. The last time it happened, Richard Nixon was president. The Vietnam War was still raging, and the most advanced phone on Earth was a rotary dial.
That last footprint was pressed into the lunar surface in December 1972. Eugene Cernan, Apollo 17. He looked back at Earth, climbed up the ladder, and no one has been back since. 54 years.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking what those 12 people actually experienced up there. The sensory stuff. The strange moments that don't make it into the history textbooks. And the bigger question. Why, with all the advances since 1972, have we never sent another astronaut onto the surface?
It's a timely question because we're finally close to breaking that streak. Artemis 3 aims for a crewed landing as early as 2027. We are sitting right at the edge of the moment when the 12 become 13.
To understand what that 13th person is walking into, we need to understand what the first 12 actually felt, smelled, heard, and wrestled with up there. Because the gap between the sensory richness of what they experienced and the barrenness of our return timeline, that's the whole story.
It's not just a trivia question about moon dust. The anecdotes those 12 astronauts brought back are engineering data. They're human factors data. If we're about to send people back for longer stays, the weird stuff they notice becomes the design spec for the next mission.
We're going to walk through both halves of this. First, what the moon was actually like for the people who stood on it. The smell, the sleep, the shadows, the dust that got into everything. Then, why we walked away and didn't look back for half a century.
The number really is vanishingly small. 12 out of roughly 117 billion humans who have ever lived. It's a statistical rounding error. You could fit every person who has ever set foot on another world into a single minivan.
With room for luggage.
With room for luggage. And you'd still have cup holders left over. The Apollo program was a geopolitical sprint. It was never designed to be a sustainable exploration program. It was designed to put boots on the surface before the Soviets did. And it accomplished that with a kind of frantic brilliance that we've never replicated.
The central tension here is that Apollo generated this extraordinary wealth of data. Thousands of photographs, hours of audio, hundreds of pounds of rocks. And yet we treated the moon as a solved problem the moment we landed on it. Been there, done that, for 54 years.
That's what makes Daniel's question so sharp. We have these 12 people who went through something no other humans have experienced, and they came back with stories that are genuinely strange. The moon is not just a gray rock in the sky. It's a place with its own sensory reality, and that reality is nothing like what you'd expect from looking at photographs.
Let's start with what it was actually like up there. And I want to begin with the thing that keeps coming up in every Apollo astronaut's account. The dust.
It's not just that the dust is everywhere. It's that it behaves in ways that don't make sense to a terrestrial brain. No atmosphere means no wind, so dust doesn't billow. It gets kicked up by a boot and it just perfect parabolic trajectories. No air resistance. Every particle is a tiny ballistic missile.
Which sounds poetic until you realize those tiny ballistic missiles are electrostatically charged and cling to everything. Spacesuits, visors, seals. The Apollo astronauts had to dust each other off before re-entering the lunar module, and even then, the stuff got inside. Schmidt called it lunar hay fever. Once they took their helmets off inside the LM, the dust that had hitched a ride irritated their sinuses.
That's the thing I want to sit with for a second. The Apollo program cost something like $25 billion in 1960s money, north of $250 billion today. It put human beings on another world using a guidance computer with 64 kilobytes of memory. And one of the most vivid things they brought back was, the dirt up there smells like a firing range and makes you sneeze.
That gap between the staggering technical achievement and the weirdly mundane human experience is what makes these 12 accounts so valuable. They're not just history, they're a preview. When Artemis lands, the 13th person to step onto the moon is going to smell that same spent gunpowder smell and feel that same clingy dust. None of that has changed in 54 years.
The smell, though, that's the detail that breaks my brain every time. Harrison Schmitt, Apollo 17, the only actual geologist to walk on the moon. He steps back into the lunar module, takes his helmet off, and the place smells like a gun range. And it's not like moon dust has organic compounds or combustion products in it. The leading theory is that the dust is so chemically reactive. It's been sitting in hard vacuum, bombarded by solar radiation for billions of years, that the moment it hits oxygen and humidity inside the LM, it oxidizes. It literally rusts on contact with air, and your nose registers that.
The moon has a smell, but only once you bring it indoors. That's the kind of detail that sounds like poetry, until you realize it's just chemistry being weird.
Schmitt wasn't the only one. Neil Armstrong mentioned it. Buzz Aldrin mentioned it. Pete Conrad on Apollo 12 joked about it. Every single crew that landed came back saying the same thing. The dust smells like wet ashes, or spent gunpowder, or, in Charlie Duke's description from Apollo 16, like the air after a firecracker goes off.
Which brings us to the visual weirdness up there. Because the dust is only half the sensory story. No atmosphere means no Rayleigh scattering, no diffusion of light. So shadows on the moon are not like shadows on Earth. They're absolute. If you're standing in shadow, you cannot see your own hand in front of your face, while 3 feet away, the sunlit surface is blinding white.
That created real problems for the astronauts. They'd be walking toward a crater and couldn't tell if the far side was a gentle slope or a sheer drop, because the shadow swallowed all the detail. The Apollo 14 crew, Shepard and Mitchell, nearly walked into a crater they couldn't see the depth of. The photographs from the surface don't capture this at all, because the cameras had limited dynamic range. The human eye was the only instrument that could really register what it looked like, and even then, it was disorienting.
The horizon is also wrong. On Earth, the horizon is about 3 miles away for a person of average height. On the moon, with a radius about a quarter of Earth's, the horizon is closer to 1.5 miles. It curves visibly. You can stand on the surface and see that you're on a ball.
That's the other thing the astronauts all reported. The sense of scale is completely broken. There are no trees, no buildings, no atmospheric haze to create depth cues. A boulder the size of a house looks like it's 20 feet away. Several Apollo commanders misjudged distances during landing because of this. Armstrong had to take manual control of Eagle because the autopilot was steering toward a boulder field he couldn't properly gauge until they were almost on top of it.
You're standing on a curved ball with no air, shadows that are voids, and dust that smells like a shooting range. And then you're supposed to sleep there.
This is the part that haunts me. Eugene Cernan holds the record. 72 hours on the surface. That means 2 sleep periods inside the lunar module. And the LM was not a habitat. It was a landing craft. The walls were so thin, basically aluminum foil and mylar, that you could hear the life support pumps, the fans, the coolant loops, all of it. Constant mechanical drone. The cabin was pressurized to about 5 pounds per square inch of pure oxygen. It was cold. Cernan described trying to sleep in his suit, helmet wedged under his head as a pillow, with the noise and the cold and the sheer psychological weight of knowing you're 238,000 miles from everything.
He said it was like trying to sleep in the front seat of a Volkswagen Beetle going down a bumpy road.
And that's not just a colorful analogy. The LM was roughly the same interior volume as a compact car. 2 men in full suits, hammocks strung across the cabin, equipment everywhere. Aldrin and Armstrong on Apollo 11 didn't even have hammocks. They just sort of propped themselves against the walls and tried to pass out. Aldrin said later he didn't sleep at all. He just lay there listening to the pumps and thinking about the ascent engine. If that single engine didn't fire the next day, they were dead.
The ascent engine had no redundancy. That's one of those facts that makes the whole thing feel less like a space program and more like a controlled gamble.
It absolutely was a controlled gamble. And the astronauts knew it, every single one of them. Which makes what they reported about looking back at Earth even more striking, because it wasn't just, oh, pretty view, it was a genuine cognitive shift. Bill Anders on Apollo, 8 to the first humans to ever see an Earthrise, said, "We came all this way to explore the moon, and the most important thing we discovered was the Earth."
Buzz Aldrin's phrase, "magnificent desolation," That's not two adjectives, that's a diagnosis. The moon is magnificent in its starkness, and desolate in a way that makes you feel like the only living thing in the universe. Until you look up and see Earth. And Earth is the only color in the entire sky.
Blue, white, green, swirling. No stars visible near it because the Earth is so bright it washes them out. Multiple astronauts described the feeling of standing on a dead world and looking at the one place in the universe they knew for certain held life. Every human being who had ever existed, except for the one other guy standing next to them in the dust.
That's the thing about magnificent desolation. It's not just a description of the landscape, it's a description of the emotional state. Awe and loneliness simultaneously.
If the moon was this strange and beautiful and terrifying, why did we walk away and not look back for half a century?
Because the moon was never the point. The point was beating the Soviets. Apollo was a Cold War weapon that happened to have a heat shield. The moment Neil Armstrong's boot touched the surface, the mission was accomplished. Everything after Apollo 11, the longer stays, the rover, the deeper science, that was bonus content.
The budget tells the story. NASA's peak funding year was 1966, 4.4% of the entire federal budget. By 1972, it was already below 1%. Nixon canceled Apollo 18, 19, and 20 before 17 even launched. The Saturn V production line was shut down. The tooling was scrapped.
We literally threw away the factory that built the moon rockets.
And then we repurposed the remaining hardware into Skylab, which was a fine space station, but it was not a lunar program. The space shuttle was designed for low Earth orbit. It physically could not leave that regime. So from 1972 until essentially now, NASA's human spaceflight program has been confined to a few hundred miles above the surface.
It's not that we forgot how to go. It's that we deliberately dismantled the capability, and then spent 50 years building something else entirely.
That's the misconception that drives me up the wall. People say we can't go back because the technology is lost. It's not lost. The Saturn V blueprints exist. The problem is, we can't just rebuild it. The supply chains are gone, the institutional knowledge is gone, the workforce is gone. You'd have to reinvent it from scratch, and at that point you might as well design something modern.
Which is exactly what SLS is, and it's costing $23 billion just to get to the first launch.
That brings us to the second barrier, which is the sheer cost of doing this in peacetime. Apollo was a war by other means. Artemis is a science program with international partners. The political urgency is fundamentally different. You can't manufacture a Sputnik moment on demand.
There's also the technical reality that returning for a longer stay is harder than Apollo's sprint. The dust we talked about, that electrostatic cling, the respiratory irritation, that becomes a serious medical problem if you're living on the surface for weeks or months. You can't just sneeze it out and move on.
The dust is arguably the number one unsolved engineering problem for long-duration lunar stays. It's not just abrasive, it's chemically reactive, and, because it's so fine, it gets deep into lung tissue. Apollo astronauts were only breathing it for a few hours. A permanent base means you're dealing with it constantly. Lungs get exposed. And there's no magnetosphere, so you're taking the full brunt of galactic cosmic radiation and solar particle events.
The moon is actively trying to kill you in ways that low Earth orbit doesn't.
Low Earth orbit is inside Earth's magnetic field. The International Space Station gets some radiation, but nothing like the lunar surface. A single major solar flare during a surface day could be fatal if you don't have a shielded shelter. Apollo got lucky. No major flares during any of the missions. You can't run a permanent base on luck.
Which means Artemis has to solve problems Apollo never even had to think about. And it's doing it with a budget that's spread across multiple administrations, multiple election cycles, and a public that's not exactly holding its breath for lunar geology.
The Artemis program is estimated at $93 billion through 2025. SLS alone ate $23 billion before it ever left the pad. The human landing system. The thing that actually gets astronauts from orbit to the surface, that's SpaceX's Starship variant, and it's still in development. Artemis 1 flew uncrewed in 2022 and mostly succeeded. Artemis 2, the crewed flyby, keeps slipping. Artemis 3, the landing, is nominally 2027, but that date has moved several times already.
The goal is fundamentally different from Apollo. Apollo is about planting a flag and picking up rocks. Artemis is about building the lunar gateway, establishing a permanent surface presence, and using the moon as a proving ground for Mars. That's an entirely different category of ambition.
It's the difference between summiting Everest once and building a research station at the summit, the sprint versus the marathon. And the marathon requires a completely different funding model, which is why you're seeing public-private partnerships. SpaceX, Blue Origin, the Artemis Accords bringing in international partners. No single nation wants to foot the entire bill for a permanent lunar base.
When Daniel asks why we haven't been back, the answer isn't one thing. It's a cascade. The political will evaporated because the race was won. The industrial base was dismantled. The cost of rebuilding it in peacetime is astronomical. And the goalposts moved from a short visit to a permanent stay, which is exponentially harder.
Yet we're closer now than we've been since Cernan climbed that ladder. The 12 are about to get company. Where does that leave us? We know why we stopped. The question now is, what we do with that knowledge? And I think the first thing to say is that we cannot replicate the Apollo model. That urgency was a product of a specific historical moment, a geopolitical emergency where two superpowers were willing to spend 4% of a national budget to prove a point. You can't manufacture a Sputnik moment on demand, and honestly, you shouldn't try.
Because if you try to fake that urgency, you get a sprint disguised as a marathon, and sprints don't build lunar bases.
Sustainable space exploration requires a completely different model. That's why Artemis looks the way it does. The human landing system is a fixed-price contract with SpaceX, not a cost-plus government program. The Artemis Accords have 39 signatories as of last year. The Lunar Gateway is being built in pieces by multiple nations. It's slower, it's messier, but it's designed to survive an election cycle.
Which is the unglamorous reality behind every grand vision of spaceflight. The rocket equation is political, not just chemical.
That brings me to the second thing I think Daniel's question forces us to reckon with. All those anecdotes we just walked through, the dust smell, the sleep deprivation, the pitch black shadows, the psychological weight, those aren't just colorful stories from 12 guys who got to do something incredible. They are the only human factors data set we have for living on another world.
We're about to use it. The dust problem alone. Schmidt's hay fever. The abrasive wear on the suit seals. The electrostatic cling. That's not a footnote. That's the design specification for every airlock, every habitat seal, every spacesuit joint on Artemis. You can't solve a problem you don't know exists. And the only reason we know it exists is because 12 people sneezed their way through it.
Same with the sleep data. Cernan's two knights in the LM, Armstrong and Aldrin, propped against the walls. That tells us that if you're going to put astronauts on the surface for weeks or months, you need a dedicated sleep module with actual acoustic damping, not a hammock strung across a landing craft. These are engineering requirements that came out of human misery.
If we're serious about Mars, which is the whole point of Artemis as a proving ground, then the psychological data matters just as much. The Earthrise effect wasn't just pretty. It was a documented shift in perspective. Multiple astronauts came back describing a kind of cognitive reframing, seeing Earth as fragile and singular. That's useful information for designing the crew support systems on a 2-year Mars mission.
The 12 weren't just explorers. They were unwitting test subjects in an experiment we're only now running the follow-up to.
For anyone listening who wants to actually follow this, and Daniel, I know you track this stuff. The Artemis program is the thing to watch. NASA's website, Space News, the Artemis blog. Artemis 2 is the crewed flyby. Artemis 3 is the landing. The next person to walk on the moon is almost certainly alive right now. They might be in their 30s, flying jets or doing geology fieldwork or sitting in a simulator somewhere.
That's the inflection point we're sitting on. The 12 will become 13, then eventually hundreds. The Apollo era was a door that opened and then slammed shut. Artemis is trying to open it again and weld it open this time.
The 12 were the first. The next generation will be the many. And the only reason we know how to build for the many is because the 12 came back and told us what the dust smelled like.
That's the question I keep coming back to. When the next boot presses into the regolith, whether it's 2027 or 2029, what does that person actually experience? Cernan had 72 hours of noise and cold and the smell of spent gunpowder. The 13th astronaut might step into a pressurized habitat with filtered air and soundproof sleep quarters.
Which is safer, and also, in some way, further from the thing. The 12 had no buffer between themselves and the moon. Every sensory input was raw. The dust in their sinuses, the pumps in their ears, the black hole shadows swallowing the ground in front of them. Artemis crews will have better engineering, but that engineering is also a layer of mediation.
There's a genuine trade-off there that nobody talks about. We want the astronauts to be safe. But the Apollo data we just spent an episode marveling at, the smell, the cling, the psychological reframing that came from being unsafe, from being exposed. If the next generation is sealed inside a habitat with HEPA filters and acoustic panels, do they come back with the same raw material?
Or do they come back with live stream footage and a checklist?
And I'm not romanticizing danger here. The dust is toxic. The radiation is real. I want those problems solved. But I also think we should be honest that solving them changes the nature of the experience. The 13th person to walk on the moon will be safer than Armstrong. They will also be less alone because they'll have constant communications, probably a camera feed, maybe a whole team on the surface with them.
That's not a loss. It's a shift. The 12 were solitary in a way that no future astronaut will ever be, because the whole point of Artemis is to make the moon less lonely.
Which means the next footprints won't be a single nation's achievement either. Apollo was an American flag planted in a Cold War battlefield. Artemis 3 will land under the Artemis Accords. 39 nations signed on, sharing data, sharing hardware, sharing the risk and the credit.
The 12 were ours. The next generation will be everyone's.
I think that's the answer to Daniel's bigger question, whether he meant to ask it or not. Why go back? Not to prove we can. We prove that. We go back because the moon isn't a trophy anymore. It's a neighbor. It's the place we're going to learn how to live somewhere else, so that someday, maybe not in our lifetimes, but someday, someone stands on Mars and looks back at two lights in the sky instead of one.
The 12 were the first. The next generation will be the many. And the only reason the many will survive up there is because the 12 came back sneezing and told us what we were in for.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1894, a Danish expedition to Greenland measured auroral green light at precisely 557.7 nanometers, a wavelength later identified as excited atomic oxygen. They recorded it with a hand-drawn spectroscope and a kerosene lamp for calibration. Modern instruments confirm the same line to within a tenth of a nanometer.
Right. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing. If you want to follow the Artemis program, and the moment the 12 become 13, we'll be tracking it. And Daniel, we'll be expecting a prompt when it happens. You can reach us at show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long ear. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.